Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
We are going to talk about the future of mobility. I wonder whether you spent a lot of time today sitting in a traffic jam. Perhaps you are able to work from home or venture out on foot to the local shops to get what you needed. If so, you were lucky. It's not that for lots of us. Perhaps you had a long commute on an overcrowded bus or train. Perhaps you used a car sharing service. Changes on how we get around in our cities, our countries and internationally has changed human history. We'll continue to do so too. But what kinds of changes to transport and our need for it will we see in the next 50 years? And how will our cities change too? Maurice Misilowski is a futurist who's a regular guest here on Nightlife. He's just spent 2 days at a massive conference on the future of mobility at the request of Ford. He joins us now. Maurice, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Good to be here, Phil.
We're also going to be joined shortly by Cheryl Connolly, who's the head futurist at Ford International and has been flown over for the conference too. Maurice, to you first. We can't underestimate the role of transport in evolving humanity. It's become even more critical than ever, probably now, in our overcrowded cities, hasn't it?
I think it has. But going back to your earlier point, you know, I totally believe that mobility is actually hardwired into our body. The moment we're put on Earth, we start to move. You know, we watch children's milestones when they walk. People that are infirm talk about the loss of freedom they have when they can't move. It is part of our DNA. And, of course, we've spent our entire human existence finding ways to go beyond our feet. You know, we travelled the world as we began to go into ships. We began to find new countries, new ways to trade, new things, that new lessons to be learned. We really have evolved humanity greatly every time we found new ways to transport. And we are on the cusp of a brand new era in transportation or mobility.
Really? In what way? Explain why.
Because what we've had up until now has been wonderful, but the car that we've seen has been around for about 110 years in its current guise. Prior to that, transportation was very much either the realm of the rich or the realm of those with shoes. And that's pretty much what it was. You know, the 25 miles from your feet was the way that the world was, 25 miles being that that's where you were born, that's where you learned, that's where you found your love, where you married, where you most probably had your work and where you died. When transportation came around in the form of cars, people began to travel further. They began to look at broader horizons. We had new industries rise. We had tourism change. Hotels came about, the ones we drive to for the first time ever. We began to see logistics change. So the way that we have food and where it's sold and where it's delivered to changed. Mm. Our retail changed. Everything about the way that it was to be human to have really changed because of transportation.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, cars changed everything. There's no question about that. It's an example. I always think of a most wonderfully refined piece of technology now too. Modern motor cars are a marvel, in relative terms inexpensive and reliable to a way that we once dreamed of. Do you think we've reached peak car?
No, what we're reaching is peak transportation. In Australia, we have this wonderful notion, you know, 100 years is what we've talked about already for it being around. We are at 84% of all Australians have access to, in the form of a licence, access to an automobile. Mm-hmm. It's quite extraordinary as a nation. And we're not yet at peak car at all, and we won't see that for another couple of decades. But what we will talk about this evening is the notion that I don't think, and many of my ilk don't think, that we will in fact own motor vehicles in the way that we have before, that our relationship with transportation will actually change dramatically, and we will go into a multimodality, which is just a fancy way of saying that we will have lots and lots of options available to us, rather than having one car in a garage that we're paying for and we're kind of stuck with that, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but that's the only choice we have. We'll, in fact, through technology and through a whole lot of new things that we're about to see that will offer us mobility, have the opportunity to really find the best way to get where we're going. And the conference was not just about the transportation or the mobility, as the words used now, that we're used to. It talked very much about the last kilometre. You know, what do we do to get to home? So there was electric scooters and there are all kinds of things that we
talked
about.
What do you mean the last kilometre? You mean from a transport hub like a train station, for example?
Yeah, possibly from a transport station, possibly from a ride share that we might have been dropped off somewhere, possibly from some other form of transport we might want to use. Well, we don't have the car. So what other things are around? And again, we're talking about a world that's going to be slightly or very different from the world we currently live in the way that we work. In your opening, you said that we're already beginning to work differently. So there will be less of us working 9 to 5. That will not disappear totally, but there'll be lots of options for that too. Not everybody will require a car for their work anymore. We're starting to see that already the millennials, those under 34 years of age by statistics that we have today,
seem to be less interested in cars.
Well, more interested in transportation and mobility than in the ownership of a car. Yeah. That's absolutely right. That they definitely want to move around, but the notion of getting a license, strangely enough, is not something that is really burns inside all of them. Certainly many, but not all of them. Mm. What you find is that, when I grew up, and I'm a baby boomer, you had to have a car because it was a sense of freedom. I mean, it was really the only way you could get away from your parents was to have that car. And it also signified to the world that you had become a quasi-adult. There were lots of things about that car. It spoke about who you were and the sort of person you might be by the car that you had. There were lots of things that were said or left unsaid but stated by this motor vehicle. And the younger generation doesn't look at cars that way. They actually have a very different relationship with it. And the millennials actually see the car more as an appliance than a motor vehicle.
Mm. Let's talk about, let's go to the sources, as it were. Cheryl Connolly is joining us this evening too. Cheryl Connolly is the head futurist at Ford. Now, that sounds like a fun job. She's been in Australia as part of the conference, the same conference that that Morris has been at. Cheryl, welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you.
Your job is to try and identify trends, see where we're going, presumably see how Ford could fit in to all of that. It's not necessarily about cars. It's about all sorts of things. Where do you see we're at the moment with the election of Donald Trump in the US and the goings on in Europe and elsewhere, an increasingly inward-looking, nativist, populist sort of feeling that people are bunkering down, they're afraid of change, not embracing it? Is that how you see it?
Well, I do think that we're certainly at a moment of transformation, and the drivers are many, and I don't know that it's just about the political landscape. I think a lot of it has to do with technology and just changing in terms of what consumers value. And I would start with the consumer because everything that I do is done through the lens of the consumer. And I think that time has become probably our most precious and rare of commodities. And when you think about what that means for the automobile, there are lots of implications. It's been reported that people lose up to 160 million hours a year to their daily commute and traffic jams. And so companies like Ford are trying to figure out how can we solve that issue. And we actually think that if we can come up with solutions, we can, in a very meaningful and purposeful way, make people's lives better. And so that's making the car experience for car ownership better. And so in terms of features and products that have been around for decades, but also means that there's opportunity to move into this new emerging opportunity that we call mobility services. So we are not just servicing those people who want to own a car. We want to help those people who don't see the need of owning a car. Because sometimes if you live in a really congested city, owning a car can be very difficult. You park it blocks away from where you live. You spend a great deal of time and waste a lot of gas looking for a parking spot. And so we're trying to solve those needs too. So we're looking at shuttle services, ride hailing services. We're even looking at bicycles. And when you start to get into that domain, it means that the way you define your customer has to change. So our customers aren't just the people behind the wheels of an automobile, but we also look at cities. Like, what can we do with city planners to try to make the congestion problems that they're facing eased a bit?
Of course, Australia has got some of the most congested cities in the world, and in some parts of Sydney or Melbourne, it's just horrendous trying to move around. And there are cities in America, I'm sure, like that. Do you in these cities? I mean, maybe not worldwide. In these cities, have we seen in essence peak car that people aren't just aren't going to want them anymore because of the difficulties in getting around?
So I don't think that's a yes or no question. I mean, I think even in the most congested cities, there are people that regard their car in different lights. I mean, there are still lots of people who consider their car an extension of their identity. And for many people, it always has been and always will be a measure of their success, a projection of status. And for that, you know, that's still something that people hold near and dear. We have lots of car enthusiasts that never, won't ever, ever give up their own car that they own outright. But even those people will have occasions where they'll say, driving my own car isn't the right option. Say it's Friday night and you're out celebrating with a bunch of your friends. Do you want to be the designated driver? I don't know many people who are raising their hand for that job. And so in that instance, they say, no, I'm going to leave my beloved car at home and I'm going to find a different solution to get from point A to point B. And I think that's a big part of it, is recognizing that there's not a one-size-fits-all solution for society in general, but there's not a one-size-fits-all for an each and every day's activity. Mm. So we actually have developed recently a platform called Ford Pass, and part of it is an app, because we think every day you have to plan your journeys and the priorities shift according to what the day is and what your needs are. And so we hope to help people navigate that. Do you want to take the train? Would you like a shuttle? Do you want to drive your own car? If you're going to drive your own car, do you want to reserve the parking spot before you leave your home? Maybe you're in a meeting, the meeting runs long. Can you extend your meter time at that parking spot longer? And all of that can be done right now through this Ford app called the Ford Pass. And the beauty of it is that that's not just for people who own Ford cars. It's actually meant for people who don't own any cars.
Mm. Do you, I mean, presumably Ford sees a future for itself as a car maker, though, doesn't it? I mean, it's not going to become a bicycle maker, is it?
Oh, thank you for clarifying that. We will always make cars, trucks, and utility vehicles. I mean, manufacturing is our lifeline, and we'll continue to invest in that. But we think that it's really important to understand that mobility services is a really growing, powerful industry, and we think OEMs like ourselves, the people who make those vehicles, should participate in it and help shape what the future of that looks like.
It's going to be, from this vantage point, I mean, you get a chance to think about it more deeply, perhaps. But from this vantage point, it looks to be like in a crowded city that you would see in Australia. It looks to be like fewer cars, more walking, more pedestrian access, more public transport. And that down the track, people are talking about autonomous vehicles. What else do you see?
Well, we also see car sharing, right? Mm. So car sharing, you know, most people who own a vehicle will find that it sits idle 95% of the time, right? So we spend so much money, we invest our hard-earning dollars into something that sits parked all of this time. But what if you could start to turn that vehicle into an opportunity to earn money? And I think we see this. I mean, this is why you have things like Airbnb. People have unused space in their home that they want to rent out. They have vacation rentals by owners. And I think this sort of what they call the side hustle or the gig economy, people are taking their underutilized assets, and that includes their cars, and they're trying to find ways to make money on it. I mean, right now there are interesting programs where you can park your car at the airport and go on a trip, and then when somebody lands that's visiting that town, they can then rent your car. And instead of paying those exorbitant airport parking prices, you actually are making a little money on the side. And that person pays a rate lower than they would if they'd gone through a traditional car rental service based out of the airport. Yeah, and all of this is happening because of kind of the power of the internet, matching supply with demand.
Yeah, in essence, that's right. I mean, with the increasing reliability and to some degree sameness of modern cars, I mean, that's a good thing, and in lots of ways too. They don't break down. They're seen as widely reliable, and lots of them in the same market segment at least look pretty much the same. Therefore, people are more interested in access to cars rather than ownership of cars, do you think?
I think, yes. I think that applies to a lot of categories, that access is often more important than ownership. And the reason for that, I think, are many. I mean, sometimes if you don't have a lot of disposable income, access gives you, these rental programs give you access to things that you wouldn't otherwise be able to afford. But maybe you're not in a situation where you have any sort of financial restriction. Some people just see ownership as burdensome. They want to be alleviated the responsibility that comes with ownership. And you see this in so many different categories. I mean, you can rent clothing and handbags. You can stage a garden. But my favorite is you can rent pets. And I think we were tracking these sort of things when we started to realize that car rentals and new paradigms of ownership for vehicles would be following suit.
We've talked a lot about autonomous cars. I mean, people are overexcited about them. They'll be a sector, a part of the mix, but that's all, isn't it? Do you think?
You know, the thing about autonomous future is it's really exciting, but I don't think it's going to be a light switch. I think it's going to be very isolated pockets, and it's not going to be universally applied. Now, Ford has said that by 2021, we will have autonomous vehicles on the road for commercial application. So that will probably be for ride-hailing services or some sort of delivery fleet. But some of our research suggests that certain parts of the world are more ready for it than others. So, for instance, India and China, when asked the question, could they imagine themselves riding in a self-driving vehicle within the next 10 years, eagerly said yes. In fact, 82% of the people in India said yes, and 78% in China. But the U.S. only came in at 40%. And the UK was only at 30%. So the appetite isn't quite the same. And we didn't ask why, but we have theories. One, I think, has to do with just kind of the infrastructure, the maturity of the infrastructure and the road safety. I think you have more densely populated cities throughout Asia. And so an autonomous future is not only more convenient, it's safer. But when you compare it to some of the Western countries, which have this rich, long history of having an emotional connection to the cars and this extension of identity, I think some people have a hard time imagining giving it up.
Because some have pointed to China in particular and the growing and the rise of the affluent middle class in China and their willingness to want cars in a road infrastructure, you know, a system that's just deliberately, that's just not unsuited for it, that it'll be a looming disaster for these countries. Are they likely, do you think, to emulate what's happened in the West in relation to car ownership?
I'm not sure, and I think a government will take a really strong stake in how they manage that. And you see China kind of using the issuance of licenses of car ownerships, you know, how many they issue a year kind of helps keep that in check. But I think that there's a lot of untapped demand in these, you know, emerging middle class opportunities. And there are people who that their greatest aspiration is to own their own vehicle. And so I think that we see a lot of growth opportunities there. But for the same reasons that we talked about, it won't be evenly distributed. And so some people won't be able to own their car and they just still need affordable transportation. And they'll get that through access models.
So, in short, we mightn't see necessarily fewer cars, but we might see a fall in ownership of cars. Do you think that's a fair observation?
Perhaps. I think that you could see some of that where, you know, some people who don't currently own a car will start to take opportunities to avail themselves of these mobility services. So maybe it's a car sharing, it's a ride hailing service or a dynamic shuttle, and it'll start to fill in the gap for them. What I think the net effect will be is that all of us will just have more options, you know, and where we go, how we go, and when we go. You know, our schedules won't be dictated by a train schedule because you'll have three or four more options.
It's often said that technology was supposed to liberate us and give us all more leisure time. It doesn't seem to have happened, does it? technology seems to have just created so many distractions that these days if you sit at a train station or even, unfortunately, in cars, people stare at their phones all the time because technology seems to have created endless distractions. Do we sometimes place a little bit too much faith in the ability of technology to liberate us?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I do believe that the greatest bait and switch of modern times was this notion that these devices would save us time, and they've done exactly the opposite. But it does seem that that society in general is really changing that, because there is a movement afoot to really find ways to meaningfully disconnect. I mean, indeed, you can go to these really high-end resorts where when you check in, you actually surrender your phone, or they have these Wi-Fi free zones so that you can disconnect. And some employers are even going so far as when they do sabbaticals for their employees, they have the employees surrender their cell phone and they disconnect them from the server. And so these things, I think, are working their way in terms of greater awareness. They're far from mainstream. But we did a study last year and we asked people about what were productive uses of their time. And I think people are redefining what is time well spent. In 9 different countries, 20% of the people we spoke to said daydreaming was actually a good use of time. So I think people are becoming more acutely concerned about the effects of being constantly connected. I mean, it shortens our attention span. We have lower retention of information. Some people say it makes us less polite. So I, for one, applaud these efforts and hope that we do find time to carve out where we are completely disconnected. Because I think you need that downtime. I think it's critical for innovation, and that seems to be something that's so prized today in the market, that if disconnecting gets you closer to that state of flow, I think this is why our best ideas come to us when we're about to fall asleep or we're in the middle of a shower. It's because we're not staring at a screen and having images and ideas and words spoon-fed to our brain.
No, we're stuck in a traffic jam.
Yes.
Yeah. Great to speak with you, Cheryl.
Same here. Thank you for the time. I really appreciate your interest in Ford and helping us share our story.
Yeah, Cheryl Connolly, and she is Ford's chief futurist. Yes, just back to you, Morris Mitalowski. I mean, reflecting on what Cheryl Connolly was talking about, will we in Australia continue to want to own cars, do you think?
I think there'll always be a group of people that want to own motor vehicles. We've talked often about the futurescape, and the futurescape, I think, offers this dynamic opportunity for us to all do what we want. So for a group of people that now enjoy their cars, that want to always own them, they'll always be able to. But increasingly, as Cheryl said, and that I believe also, there will be a great number of people that will not want to own a motor vehicle, or even if they do, they won't necessarily want to drive that car all of the time. So there'll be lots of opportunities. But again, it comes back to that futurescape also of the way we're going to live, and I think that will dictate that we shan't need as many cars, or we shan't need to own a car in the way we have before to be able to achieve what we want to achieve in life and in work and in love.
Okay, let's get to some calls. Dave, sorry, you've been hanging on there for a bit, Dave. Hello? Hello, Dave. G'day, Dave.
Being a petrolhead, I thought I'd better give you a ring.
Hey, Dave.
Seeing we might be losing the cars off the road.
Well, maybe. It's interesting, isn't it? But, there are parts of big cities at the moment where you do question whether or not, you know, it's worth having one, for short distances at least.
Well, I was mixed up in the automotive trades ever since I was a kid, I suppose.
Yeah.
But when you've got a small business, you've always had to provide your customer with car parks. Well, these big businesses, they're now charging you to park at their car park.
Yes.
And as far as the council goes, they're even worse.
Yeah.
And as kids, we're brought up pushing dinky toys around and matchbox toys.
That's right.
Well, the automotive world, being the car manufacturers, they made billions of dollars out of us. And now things are going to slow down. I said, well, clear off. We've made their money out of you.
Yeah. What do you think, Boris?
Yeah, I don't think that we're going to see less cars on the road, Dave. I think, in fact, by gross number, we will see more because our population will be larger. But what we will see are all different kinds of cars. And it's going to take this autonomous world that people are talking about in its full-blown level 5, which means we can walk into a motor vehicle, sit down, have no control over it, and it does everything.
That's not going to happen, is it?
Well, it will, but it's 20 years. It's 15,
maybe
20 years away.
Maybe. Yeah.
Being a bloke, do you want to not have control of your car?
Yeah. You're not going to put your kids, Morris, you're not going to put your young kids into a vehicle where no one's in charge.
Look, 15 years from now, I absolutely will. I totally believe by 2050.
I'd bet you a bottle of good red you don't.
I bet you I do. So I think by 2050, in fact, it'll be difficult to get a driver's license in Australia and elsewhere. You'll have to actually prove a case for it. And we're talking 15 years now away. But I'm fairly convinced that we will have a car that will do that. But the road between here and there, to use that pun, is not about driverless, it's about less driving cars. And we have already adopted this great desire to have all sorts of automation inside a car. Mm. You know, we have cars that make sure that we're staying in our lane. We have cars that press the accelerator continuously for us. We have cars that do all kinds of tricks that 10 years ago we would have thought were impossible in the average motor vehicle, and we now accept as being ordinary.
Well, while I got you there, I built up a 1935 Chevy Roadster with a 68 Corvette chassis and complete running gear underneath it. But then alongside that, I've got a trike sitting there with a Volkswagen motor in it. And I've got all the jigs and miles from manufacturing them.
But Dave, you are a petrol head.
I am a petrol head.
Thanks, mate. Appreciate your call. Yeah, John is on the line. Yes, John.
John from Ballina, yeah.
Yeah. Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Yeah, thanks from Philip and Cheryl. But I learned to drive when I was about 8 years old in a Ford Model 8, and I've had Fords and Fords and Fords all my life, so Cheryl would be very happy about that. I've had electric vehicles these days. Have we got any developments on those ones?
Well, I don't know. We've discussed electric cars a lot with Toby Hagen on the program here. There's almost none of them sold in Australia, partly because there doesn't seem to be much incentive for governments to prioritise their purchase. Where do you think they're going, Maurice?
Yeah, I would agree. In Australia and elsewhere, they're not selling all that well. It's also not just so much the government regulation or government incentive, which is absolutely part of the cause. It's also that our infrastructure is not really set up for it. We are very much a society, of course, that uses petrol and diesel, and we know where to fill up our cars, and we are within distance to be able to do that quite comfortably. So the infrastructure that supports it is not there yet. You look at companies like Tesla, and he has said that he's putting in a whole fleet of charging stations in big cities, and he believes that his way around that is actually to do it himself. There are apps that we can get that will tell us where to charge, but the main reason is just simply that the cost is still prohibitive, and using them on long distances is really not within most people's desire.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know some of them are getting better and better, but...
They are. That's true, John, and it's interesting. They are better. And, that the Elon Musk Tesla company, which sells electric cars in Australia, I mean, they're exceptionally good cars, got long range, I think 300 k's at least.
They're up to about 500 now.
Yeah, but they're a very, very expensive car. I mean, they're not within reach of even the ordinary person, really.
But he has a new model coming out next year or two. I mean, he always fluffs about the timing. And that in America will be somewhere around the 40,000 US. Mm. And we don't know what will happen in Australia. It'll be a year or more after that. And I'm assuming it'll be somewhere around the 50K mark.
Mm. Yeah, but I don't know. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, it's interesting. I feel, personally, that all the solar panels are going up all over the place, and... plug-in electric cars, and it just seems to be the way to go.
All right, John, thank you. Maurice, can I ask you this? It's not the cities aren't really just the problem of cars. It's the problem of parking. The truth is, even if I don't care whether you have a self-drive car, or I don't care whether the thing runs on potatoes. There's nowhere to put it. That's the problem. Yeah. And no one's really talking about innovative new ways to put it anywhere, are they?
Well, they are, because a lot of these cars into tomorrow's landscape and not far down the track will actually be able to park themselves. You've got Volvo, Ford.
Yeah, but there's nowhere to park it though, Maurice.
But the car will be able to find its spot. And again, that doesn't make sense in today's landscape, but it does moving forward 5 years from now. So what the car is looking for is a spot perhaps in a shopping centre that's designated as no one being in it, and it will drive around on its own until it finds a spot, and then you'll be able to whistle at it through an app or something else for it to come back and find you. But the notion of parking has been a horrendous question over the last 20 or 30 years and only getting worse. But the other issue around this also is changing the places that we live, and one of the wonderful ripple effects of this new transportation possibility is that we can start to extend our cities out. If we are moving into cars that are able to do some of the driving themselves, if that's not as much of a chore, then we can start looking at putting satellite cities out, making them quite accessible, and that will start to alleviate parking. if we start to play with the notion of when we work, where we work, and how we work, and not so many of us have to be in the same place at one time, again, that starts to change the shape of our drive, of the cars on the road, and of parking.
Hmm. Why do we build shopping centres in the way we do, which simply acts as a magnet for lots of cars, which can't park anywhere because there's nowhere to park? In other words, why do we aggregate commercial centres together like this rather than disaggregate them? Wouldn't that be better planning?
It's a really interesting question. It actually goes back quite a while to the nature of retail. Now, prior to the 60s, most retail was done as strip shopping centres, and this is a gender-biased comment. But the reason for that was predominantly because it was females that did the day-to-day convenience shopping. They did not have access to motor vehicles, by and large, so they had to be able to walk to shopping centres. What happened in the 60s, it began to become possible for many females to drive, and that changed the nature of shopping, because if I could drive, I didn't want to go up the street. So we began to adopt the mall, the American mall model, and that really is what drove this big push into malls that we have now and the death of the strip shops.
That's right. Malls were driven by motor cars, weren't they? Yeah.
Absolutely. Because what it offered you was a huge variety of shops. You no longer went for convenience goods, the milk, the bread, the ham and other things. You went for fashion. You went to meet people, to go to the movies, to do all kinds of things and to spend a lot more time there. So the notion of the mall was really only a derivative of our ability to transport or to move ourselves there. And the car park was the necessary attachment in order to say, yes, if you can come here with your motor vehicles, leave them somewhere and spend a couple of hours shopping.
Mm. John's got an interesting point. Yes, John, hi.
How are you?
Not bad.
Hey, John.
I've actually got 2 points. The first one is actually about insurance, but the second one was just to do with parking, and I think parking and solar and electric cars will basically cancel each other out, because my electric car will drive me to work, it'll drive home, connect itself to the solar grid, and it'll basically power itself up from the sun while I'm at work, and then when I want to be picked up, it'll disconnect from the solar, it'll have a full battery, it'll come pick me up. So workplaces won't need anywhere near the amount of parking they've got now.
Yeah, John, I kind of agree with you. I mean, I see that world as well, where the car will be able to know where it is, able to top itself up or to go away quite quietly and wait for you to come back. We talk a lot about solar and electric, but there are all kinds of other possibilities out there, and we're not exploring them in any great way, but there's kinetic energy, which is simply energy that's created by the car movement itself. And one of the first cars that were produced back in the late 1800s was produced using steam, and we haven't gone back to that. And I'm not seriously suggesting we do, but I'm saying that there are a whole lot of other options out there that are being explored as well. Maybe one of those comes along in 10 or 15 years.
Absolutely. The other thing I was going to say was driver cars, as in cars that I drive, will probably stick around in the country for a bit longer. But in the city, the other thing I can see happening is insurance companies won't want to insure you if you want to drive the car yourself, because driverless cars will be able to cater better for other driverless cars because they'll be able to talk to each other. But I will be the unknown spanner that will make more accidents.
Yeah, okay. This is a point. This gets back to this issue, doesn't it, Morris, of whether or not you see a future where people will be, like, being allowed to drive a car might get much more difficult.
I think it will. As I said, I'm confident that by 2050 it will be difficult to have a driver's license. In fact, I'm confident that my grandkids, of which I have none as far as I'm aware as of an hour ago, that they will look back and ask me as grandpa, did you really drive a car? Did you sit behind and how did you manage to do that? I think our world will move that quickly over the next 30, 40 years in this space. And to John's point about insurance, I've worked with insurance for the last 10 or 15 years as well, and we've explored this area of what it means to, in fact, insure an autonomous or a semi-autonomous or a less driving car. And it's a really difficult conundrum because at this stage it's unclear as to who, in fact, would be at fault if we're not physically touching the car. Is it the manufacturer of the motor vehicle itself? Is it the component that caused the issue? We've had some precedent in America. There is one state in America, that California, that has stated clearly last year that in advance of anything happening, that whoever was in charge of the vehicle, regardless of whether they were holding the steering wheel or not, would be the liable party. So this whole thing has to be worked out. There's a lot of politics around it. There's a lot of ethics we need to work through, cultural change, all kinds of things that we'll need to come to terms with before these cars even begin to drive on our roads.
Mm. Okay. All right, thanks, John. Warren is on the line. Hello, Warren.
Hey, Phil. I don't know your guest name, unfortunately.
Morris.
Oh, hey, Warren.
Hey, mate, how you going?
Yeah,
mate,
good.
I'm an interstate truck driver, and honestly, I can't see any of these autonomous vehicles being on the road at any time, even by 2050. Like, I don't think any government will ever legislate that you don't have to be behind the wheel to be there in case of emergency. Like, nothing's foolproof, even a computer. Like, even your iPhone can, you know, can crash from time to time. It's just, it's a pipe dream. It won't happen for the next 100 years. I really don't, all due respect, Morris, I don't really think it'll happen. And I'm driving through conditions at the moment I don't think an autonomous vehicle will be able to deal with. You know, like, in all reality. And Phil, just one other thing, you're talking about autonomous trucks and cars.
Yeah.
What about motorcycles? Do you want to sit in your Trumpy while someone else steers it?
there is never going to be an autonomous motorcycle, Warren.
That's a step too far.
I will be riding my Trumpy. That's right.
Yeah. So it's just never going to happen. Not in any, like,
Warren,
not in our lives.
Do you remember a time when you couldn't get into a? Well, you probably don't. But once upon a time, you could never ride a Lyft without a Lyft driver.
No, that's right. And unfortunately, Phil, I do remember. I've been in the transport industry a long, long time. I've been riding motorcycles since I was 16 years, 9 months. I'm about your age.
Yeah.
And honestly, all due respect, Morris, I just cannot see it happening. And I don't think any government will ever legislate that they leave a computer wholly and solely in charge of a vehicle without someone actually sitting in the seat.
Yeah, well, it's a persuasive point. Thanks, Warren. Morris, what do you think about that? Because, I mean, there are set technologies that have been invented. The jetpack, for example, which does work, but no government is ever going to regulate it. Because
and the flying just, car, yeah, the flying the car flying, also.
The flying car, for that matter, too. Yeah. I mean, just because technology invents something doesn't mean it happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And might driverless cars be in that space, actually?
Look, I would agree with many technologies, and I'm the first to say that because we can doesn't mean we should. We seem to have come a long way, we being the manufacturers, a lot of the people behind the scenes, down this less driving car road. It seems to be something that's growing momentum. Every car manufacturer on the planet, except for one, Porsche, has said that they will have a driverless car within the next 5 to 10 years, if not sooner. Porsche was interesting because it made the comment that the only reason you buy a Porsche is because you want to drive it. The last thing you'd want to do is sit in it. So it was an interesting aside. But having said that, you know, the governments are slowly moving towards this space too. There are really strong arguments in the belief, and we can't prove it, of course, that in fact when we have a volume of these driverless cars on the road, our roads will actually be safer. There's lots of projections about deaths that are going to be saved, about all sorts of things that will happen because cars will be able to communicate with each other. I get Warren's point, and I would also be sceptical, but I think 50 years is far too long. As I said, I think we'll have these less driverless cars in the next 5 years, maybe 7 years, and we will slowly wean off that over the next 10 to 15 years. But I'm fairly confident 2030 or so that 1 in 4 cars sold in Australia will be capable of pushing the button and moving it along.
Mm. Glenn says, Philip, this is the most unmitigated load of rubbish I've ever heard. Ford invented the traffic jam and now their futurist is trying to tell us how they want to help. Come on, don't treat plebs like morons. I live in a regional area. Parking's not a problem, but the 20-kilometre walk to work is a bit of an issue. Well, I agree with you, Glenn. That's an entirely valid point. And in regional Australia, I think there will always be driven cars because, you know, the self-drive option probably doesn't make a lot of sense in regional and rural Australia.
Now, it may not in regional areas, but to regional areas. So I've done some work in the last couple of years around this notion with regional tourism operators, both in Australia and in New Zealand. And we've talked about the notion of, again, this is 10 years out before this begins, but where people, instead of getting into a tour bus, for instance, can get into some sort of an autonomous vehicle and can begin to explore regional areas in ways that they haven't done before. So one of the things that I've said is, and totally believe, that around the mid-2020s, going into 2030, is that regional tourism will actually begin to see an uptake in people visiting those areas because of these sorts of vehicles on the roads.
Yeah, okay. All right, Maurice Misilowski is my guest, a futurist. We're talking about the future of mobility. Some part of it's about automated cars. Can I just put this to you, though, Maurice? That if cities are to get unclogged and easier, plan better places to move around, we have got to talk about fewer cars. As I say, I don't care whether they go on run on potatoes or automated or not automated. We've got to have fewer of them, don't we?
Well, eventually we do. We've got to get
Not eventually, soon.
Well, soon, but we've got to get to the point also, as Cheryl said, and you commented with her as well, that I don't want to paint a picture where we're going to get into this utopian world of motor vehicles somewhere in the next 20 years where it all dances sweetly and everybody plays nicely. We're not going to. It's still going to be messy and ugly, and there are people on the road that drive and people that don't. So I don't think we're headed for utopia. But I think what we can do is to untangle some of the traffic jams that we have, to untangle some of the car usage. I'm also very, very keen on this, what we see now as evidence through statistics of people saying, look, maybe I don't need to have two cars in the home. One is sufficient as long as the other person can get to and from, and we can use a car share or find some other way of transporting ourselves. There are all sorts of things, I think, that are going to offer us the opportunity to, as I said, untangle and maybe get some cars off the road. Eventually, we may go beyond that, but I think that is really in Warren's, you know, that 50-year horizon before we get to the point of possible utopia.
Okay, Maurice Misilowski is my guest. We're talking the future of mobility. Maurice is a futurist. He's been on the program a bit too. All right, Val is on the line with a fair enough question. Hello, Val.
Hi, Val. Good evening.
Hello.
Yeah, look, you folks seem to be talking about the big cities where somebody can pop out to their local cafe for a latte and they've got the train station at the doorstep, and then they can jump on a train to get home and a bus at the other end to take them near to their doorstep. But what about the folk out in the country? Like, they still can't even get the jolly NBN out here, let alone autonomous cars. Goodness me.
I'm with you, Val.
How do you think a car's going to get to Birdsville?
Val, my comment to that would be, I think we'll get driverless cars before we get the NBN out to you. Let's take that up as another topic for another day.
I agree with you, Val. If we can't even get something so obviously sensible like the NBN up, how are we going to get this up? Fair enough. Thanks, Val.
I think you've
struck gold with that one. Yes, Darren, hello.
Hi, Maurice and Philip, how are you?
Not bad, man.
Look, I've read just about everything I can find on autonomous cars, trucks, and I read a very interesting article a few weeks ago, and I'd like to ask your guest his thought on the question. Part of the development of automated cars is going to be for society to make decisions on values of lives. Now, what I say there is, you know, that we've all heard of examples where people in trucks and cars have basically given their own lives to save other people in accident situations. That's happened in split seconds. Now, in an autonomous vehicle, that's going to have to be pre-programmed. Society is going to have to make the decision on value of life. Is society ready to do that?
What situation are you talking about, Darren?
Okay, imagine in front of you, you've got a small child or an animal.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry, from what I've read, this is one of the biggest issues, and it's particularly applicable here in Australia. And, you know, look, there's been plenty of truck drivers who have seen children on the road or whatever and have turned off and been killed in the process. And lots of people in cars have done the same thing. Now, in autonomy, you've got to pre-program every situation that could possibly happen. So you therefore got to make a value call on whose life you're going to save.
Darren, you're absolutely right. In fact, what you've brought up is the thing that we talk about over coffee and wine. It's absolutely that value choice. You know, in our discussion, and nothing about either, we talk about if you're in that situation on the road, is it the nun or the group of children that ends up getting
exactly
killed?
Exactly right.
Which one do you choose from? And there isn't an answer to that. And that's one of the difficulties, which is why before I alluded to the fact that not only does the technology have to be right, but the culture and the ethics. And it's amazing the group of people that are involved in this conversation. We're not going to find a technological answer to your question, Darren, nor should we, because There isn't. You're absolutely right. There isn't. That's why we're not going to find it. So what we're going to have to do is come to a decision at some point. Is with the technology that we have and its capabilities as we're aware of it, is that enough for our society to allow them on the road? That's a question we have to ask. We can't just assume the answer's yes to that. There are lots of things we need to go through. But that's exactly the kind of conversation. It goes beyond technology to this human aspect of what do these motor vehicles actually do on the road? How will they be able to make those decisions for us?
Look, I believe that the technology can be built to a stage. Now, look, trucks and cars in 20, 25 years' time, whatever the time frame is, will become not totally autonomous, but I do not see that we're ever going to be able to bridge that social question that's got to happen before we can allow them to go without a driver.
I reckon, Darren, I don't know whether you agree, but I can see them having a role on set routes for some deliveries.
I agree with
you. Know, this notion of unpiloted pieces of technology tooling around the road with someone's kids in them, I just don't see it happening. I mean, no parent is going to put their kids in a car with no one responsible.
It would only take one accident 12 months after it all started for the whole thing to come screaming down.
Exactly, yeah.
Because society hasn't made this decision about values.
Thanks, Darren. Good call. Thank you, mate. Morris, sorry.
So to Darren's point, I absolutely agree with these ethics because that's the thing that keeps me awake at night too. So not walking away from that, but if I can just tease out that conversation into this mythical land. Now, we're talking about artificial intelligence, which I don't believe exists yet. We have machine learning. So we're already down the road of being able to possibly get our machines to be able to think. Now, that's a 15, 20, 25-year horizon. But really way out there wacky stuff at this time of night. Yesterday, Elon Musk announced a brand new company called Neuralink. Elon Musk being the Tesla guy, the SpaceX guy, the guy that's doing really unusual things that we thought would never happen. His Neuralink company, yesterday, $1 billion put into it, billion with a B already, is its sole purpose in life is to connect a human brain to a computer, to be able to put electrodes somehow into the brain and for the thought processes of the brain to be able to transfer automatically into technology. Now, I know that sounds like a step too far. I know it sounds like I'm on something. But Elon Musk talks about this as a possibility, again, 10, 15, 20-year horizon with a long leeway after that. So, yes, today, given what we have, these things might not seem possible, but we're living in a world of possibility that we've never seen before. We all have mobile phones in our pockets, and that's only been 9 years, and look at how much the world has changed because of that. So I'm not necessarily disagreeing with what we're saying, with what others are saying, but I am fairly confident we will see some kind of less driving car on the road within the next 10 years.
Okay. Paul, yeah, sorry, you've been waiting on there for a bit, sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. G'day, Jack. How are you going?
Yeah, good, Paul.
Hey, Paul.
I've got a quick put voices I haven't sort of heard anyone else talk about, and that's along the lines of a share service where cars, or not necessarily electric cars, but any type of car, like new, modern, reliable vehicle, would be owned by a corporation or even the car manufacturer, and individuals, say like myself, would pay a monthly fee or a fee every month to have a...
That happens now, though, Paul, isn't it? There are a number of companies in the market doing that right now.
Yeah, look, I agree again with you, Paul, and there are models of that. There's an interesting one coming out of the States called Wave, W-A-I-V-E, not available in Australia and very, very limited, but it offers free motor vehicles. And it offers free motor vehicles on the same way that we might now use Spotify or some kind of streaming to be able to listen to music. What it says is you can use our car, but the car has advertising on it. And these are all sorts of electronic billboards that literally change the message depending on what suburb you drive in. So I'm not, again, suggesting we're all going to be in those. But to your point, I think we're going to see lots of options down the road for things that we now think are solid, like the old record that we all had to buy and we couldn't think how we could possibly have music any other way, and today we see there is.
Paul,
I think we're really at that point.
Paul, one obvious thing seems to me to be, you know, why haven't we seen by now a form of car Airbnb?
Yeah, exactly. And I work away You know, like work shift work sort of 7 on, 7 off. And when I'm away, my car just sits in the driveway and sits there, you know, going to waste.
Exactly.
And I could just have a car. If you had an app where you book it in and you book it in, okay, I need it for these 4 days. And you have a car for those 4 days. And you drop it off. You think it's like a hire service, but at a lower cost, sort of.
We already see that service. There's a service in Australia called carnextdoor.com that does exactly that, that allows you to rent out or to share out your motor vehicle. And it's your motor vehicle. They cover the insurance on that for you. And then your neighbour will come and pick it up with your permission and put it back. So we're already beginning to see those services around.
My texter says, what are your thoughts on the possibility of autonomous cars being programmed for use in terrorist attacks? Well, yeah, I mean, that's always a possibility, I guess, but that is in a sense, it's in a sense another conversation.
It is, and we've seen humans do terrible things in motor vehicles, so it's not just technology that's going to go awry there.
Yeah, look, thanks for the calls, everyone. Brad, I did want to talk to you, but we just ran out of time because Brad works in the industry, in the artificial intelligence industry, and has worked on trucks and mining machinery, of course, where we've seen a lot of autonomous and driverless things around. Yeah, okay, Morris, maybe Cheryl's right. We have our best ideas when we're not doing anything, so we're going to get lots more opportunities given the number of traffic jams that people in the big cities at least are subject to. But you're quite right. Whoever thought about the revolution with the smartphone, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. And really the discussion tonight, as it always is when we get together to have this conversation, is not about it happening today, but just opening ourselves to the possibilities that the world changes dramatically. And we've seen so many examples of that. We're not trying to say that this is definitely the way forward, but it is part of a landscape.
Yep. All right. Morris, good to talk. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.